Hello and welcome to Things Musicians Don't Talk About with your hosts Hattie Butterworth
and me, Rebecca Toll.
Within our vibrant musical world, it can often feel that the struggles and humanity of musicians is lost and restricted.
Having both suffered in silence with mental, physical and emotional issues, we are now looking for a way to voice musicians' stories, discuss them further and to connect with the many others who suffer like we have.
No topic will be out of bounds as we are committed to raising awareness for all varieties of struggle.
So join me, Hattie and guests as we attempt to bring an end to stigma by uncovering the things musicians don't talk about.
Musicians Don't Talk About is supported by the Royal Society of Musicians. Since 1738, they have been providing vital financial assistance, advice, and guidance to music professionals unable to work due to accident, illness, stress, or anxiety. Whether you're working as a performer, administrator, technician, or teacher, and everything in between, they're there to help. If you know of someone in need, you can contact them in confidence by visiting their website, which is www.rsmgb.org, or you can contact them by ringing 020 7629 6137. Support their work by becoming a member or donating today.
Hello, dear listener. Welcome back. It's me, Becca. We have another treat in store for you today in the form of a podcast episode. Surprise, surprise. We have the fantastic Zygmunt de Sommaguy. And as in true TMDTA fashion, I am just recording a little spiel before we start to explain what happened with the recording. It's not as bad as you think, honestly. It's not as bad as it has been in the past. We originally met in a cafe and then we forgot to check the closing time, so got kicked out almost immediately once we'd set up. So then we were furiously trying to think of somewhere to go record, so we went over to the Royal Opera House, which is not known for its, you know, quiet, no background noise kind of vibe, but also there weren't any seats, so we had to move a table, and then we got told off by the staff. It was a mess. So the end of the interview gets kind of cut off abruptly because we were told that we were violating health and safety standards and that we were a hazard. So I then asked Ziggy to record their voice, like a voice note of their win of the week at the end. So that's what you'll hear, and that's why it's a little bit of a strange ending. But regardless, I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. I hope that all of your marches have got off to a good start. I'm sitting here, my cat just jumped off my lap. I guess she's not had a good march. I'm sitting here in my study, looking out the window. It's dark, but I've got a candle flickering away, keeping me company on this late night record. So without further ado, welcome to our chat with Ziggy.
Today, Things Musicians Don't Talk About is coming from the entrance to the loo at the Royal Opera House.
And the water machine.
And the water station. So if you hear some extra background noise, that'd be
it's
why.
It's intentional.
But we are here with a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself, Ziggy, to the podcast?
Yes, hello. My name's Zygmunt de Sommaguy. Call me Ziggy, it's probably easier. I'm a composer, sometimes performer, sometimes writer. Artistic director, I guess, of music magazine Preludes with an X because we're edgy. and doing things around in the general kind of creative contemporary music space is probably how to describe it.
So you got in touch with us like ages ago with an email that just listed so many topics that I was like, yes,
sure.
We've got to talk to Ziggy because there was like burnout, rejection, self-doubt, all these things, and I was like,
yes. I feel like, tell us about you as a musician and a composer. Like,
Tell us your journey.
Yeah, just my kind journey. Of brief overview of the journey and like where you're at today in terms of your work and stuff.
Sure. I guess where's a good place to start? How far back are we going to go? I mean, when I grew up, like music was a big part of my like life, and I was kind of surrounded by different styles of music from different people. A big thing for me was like I was diagnosed with ASD when I was like 5, and a lot of the time that's kind of like that's felt like it's really kind of shaped how I've like viewed things. Like I don't know if that's the words I would use,
like the perspective on the world and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And like going into like secondary school and things, like I was like music very much was such an important part of what I was doing, but I wasn't necessarily that involved with classical music, so to speak. I learned piano, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't quote unquote good. I didn't really do many of the grades. I got bored of them. And I didn't play in like any orchestras or anything. I didn't know, like for quite a long time, and we'll go into this, I didn't know that you could be a composer. Like it just wasn't something that was really taught. And I remember like a lot of comments of like, oh, well, classical music's like, you know, this particular thing for this particular group of people. And yeah.
You don't fit into that.
Yeah, exactly.
Or it's not a world that's like open to you.
Yeah.
So then I guess fast forward to like going to university and stuff. You told us that you did your undergrad at Leeds. Mm-hmm. Tell us about why you studied music, but like, you know, composition, it sounds like, wasn't actually your main focus at that point.
It's strange because I feel like throughout a lot of my kind of like school years, I kind of knew that I wanted to do music in some way, shape or form, but there wasn't necessarily like, because I didn't really know what pathways were available, I didn't necessarily know exactly how I was going to do that or in what respects. So I kind of just applied to do music because that's what I liked and that's what I was good at. I did music GCSE and A-level, and there was a bit of composition involved, but it was always, I think, seen as a bit of an afterthought. Like, it wasn't really something that was taken so seriously in that respect. And, I mean, I chose Leeds because it was a cool city. Like, that's basically, I liked the vibe. I liked a lot of the bands that were coming out of there, and I thought it would just be a cool experience. And the city itself absolutely was. And I mean, the uni and the music department were cool as well. But even then, like I had much more of a focus on musicology and this kind of like, it kind of a lot of the time felt like I was being kind of railroaded into a particular area of research about music, which, well, yes, of course, like is valid and important, was not necessarily what I felt like was my calling or anything of that sort. So I spent much more time in Leeds hanging out with like musicians and like playing in bands outside of like university than I did like in terms of spending time like in uni. I played in a band called High Visions up there, and we actually continued for a little bit after I left Leeds as well. We played a load of shows, we've toured around, we released a few EPs, but it was a wonderful time. But I think there was a point where I kind of was like, okay, how do I want to do more with my art. How do I do that?
So tell us about the next step of like masters in composition. And you told us that you'd spent 2 years in London before that working in a bar.
Yeah.
And then how did composition...
Yeah, not in London, in Kensington.
In Kensington.
All places.
Kensington, yes.
Kensington. Yeah, how did composition become like not worthy choice, but like realistic idea?
That's a good word.
There you go.
Yeah, that's a good word. Love that. So, I mean, when I came back from Leeds, I was kind of like stumped. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I hadn't been prepared for like anything. And like, I actually spent 2 weeks, like this was after the summer. I had a very weird, tumultuous time after graduation where I ended up sofa surfing in Leeds for way longer than I wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
Because I kind of had this idea in my head of like, well, you know, like make it work. I'll find a job somewhere. Spoiler alert, did not find a job anywhere.
No.
And just kind of ended up sofa surfing until everyone got sick of me.
No.
And then just kind of coming back to London with absolutely no plan and feeling very kind of like dejected. And then just in terms of finding my feet, it took me quite a while. I worked like a few odd jobs. I did some catering stuff around, like, there's some stories here somewhere. I've worked on the top, you know, the top bit of the Tower Bridge.
Yeah.
You know, that walkway.
What?
Yeah, I think two shifts there.
Oh, wow.
What do you mean? Like, in
catering?
Yeah.
Like for events?
Not walking?
No, not walking. Well, I walked up there, but that wasn't the main thing I did.
Oh my gosh.
I think the first pint I ever poured was up there as well.
What?
Before I knew how to pour
pints. That's a story for the grand show.
Claim to fame.
Yeah. And there are a few other things. I worked at British Summertime in 2018.
Oh.
And that was very fun. I saw a load of very cool bands. I met a load of very interesting people. I stood within a 3-meter radius of Samuel L. Jackson.
As this is an audio format, you can't see mine and Hattie's faces, which are absolutely shook.
Well. If there's any reason to become a composer, it's Samuel L. Jackson, honestly.
I don't think this is through composing, though, right?
No.
not at all. I mean, this is still me not knowing what
so,
I was doing.
Yeah, if there's any reason to not become a composer, it's that. So there's been a lot of you, like, finding your own path and finding things that resonate with you. And, like, it sounds like the course wasn't quite... it didn't quite resonate with you, so you kind of started finding music for your band and this kind of stuff. So where has that led to today, where it sounds like now you're at a kind of pinnacle of, maybe not pinnacle because that assumes a kind of destination.
They've peaked.
But yeah, how has that influenced where you are today?
Essentially what happened was I found this thing that called composition. I was like, you can write music as well as play it, and that's a way into like doing things. Oh my god, I didn't know you could do that. So it was like one summer I was between jobs and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna apply to a conservatoire for composition and see what happens. I got rejected from most of them, fair enough. But Birmingham Conservatoire reached out. I had an interview with them, and they, to my complete shock and surprise, were really invested in the work I'd done with my band. We're really invested in the fact that I was like making little pieces just for myself on solo piano. I'm really invested with the fact that I was like, I'm just going to do some weird electronic stuff that I thought was nothing. And they really picked up on that. And immediately I was like, okay, I think this is the place for me, you know, like, let's do it. Let's see what happens. And so I went, and like all expectations of what composition was and what classical music was, like, despite having like studied classical music in school, was still a newcomer to most of it. Like, all of those preconceptions are completely shattered. Like, I mean, I was part of an incredibly open community and cohort there. Like, I mean, people like Michael Volters, Sean Clancy, my teachers, Ed Bennett, Howard Skempton, Edwin Roxburgh, they were all just so, so influential on me. And also I shared like the court, like in our year, we had people like basically people from all different backgrounds. You have people who are like from very, you know, conventionally classical backgrounds. People who, you know, came from like singer-songwriter backgrounds. Someone who was like an AV designer. That was amazing. And also someone who like didn't have any degrees and basically made music touring with like Swans and Shushu and like getting involved in that scene.
Fair enough.
Swans
the band.
I thought you meant the animal.
Going around recording swans and making music out of it.
I thought it was really cool.
That's not a bad idea, honestly. Probably quite peaceful.
I think we should all be recording some swans around at some point.
So today you are on the opera making course at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Mm-hmm. So I guess, hearing your background, I guess a lot of people might not see opera as like the natural progression.
Here we are in the opera house.
You know, exactly. you've already created one opera, I seem to have read. Mm. What is it about opera that is like taking your imagination at the moment as a composer?
So for me, I'm going to borrow a phrase from Arbel Esbenshada, who's a wonderful composer and wonderful friend of mine, who also did Opera Makers a little while back.
Hey.
And that's the fact that in opera, the very fabric of the music can kind of express so much of the dramaturgy, of the narrative. It feels like, for me, opera is like such a holistic, collaborative art form. We're basically kind of, it's maximalist, but also can be minimalist at the same time. And those two things working in tandem is like, that's what really resonates with it for me. That looks so professional. Oh my God.
These people just walked past and went, oh my God, they're doing a podcast.
Yeah, damn. Yeah, we are.
Yeah. You know.
Also, like, you talking about opera in that way makes it sound like we're kind of
doing it for gunning, the opera house.
Gunning for a sponsorship the opera, from the Opera House.
The Opera House podcast.
You're talking about it in such a, like, I don't know, just such a positive way that opera's, like, amazing.
Yeah. And it is. Later, Ollie. But, yeah, for me, I kind of fell into opera. Like, I fell into most things in contemporary music and composition. Like, almost everything was kind of an accident. And we might go into that. Maybe it comes from imposter syndrome as well. I'm not sure. But the way I fell into opera, so to speak, was I kind of just, like, I met someone at a wedding. And we had some glasses of wine and we were talking. And this was just before I started my master's at Birmingham. And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to start a degree in composition. And the conversation kind of splayed out into, have you ever thought about opera? And I was like, my dad liked Wagner, and that's about as far as I got.
Like you said, we'll talk about it later, but why, where better to start than now? Tell us more about this imposter syndrome.
So I think a lot of people will feel this to certain degrees, and it's strange because it's the more that I've like gotten involved in our sector, the more prominent it becomes, but in very different ways. So a lot of the time when I started, I was like, okay, I'm not going to know anything coming in. That's great. Which then slowly stemmed into oh God, I don't know anything, but wait, no, I've been doing this long enough that I should know these things. And it's very, I think, for me at least, it's very easy to get into that kind of anxious headspace of like, okay, everyone here knows way more than I do. Do I even belong in this space? Like, what am I doing? And there's a lot of the time, and I think this happens especially in a lot of institutional environments. In a lot of kind of like more DIY spaces, I'm not sure how much this resonates, but in a lot of like institutional spaces, there can be a lot of pressure sometimes to be, you know, like, oh, everything's got to be like perfect because, you know, they've got eyes on you, or, you know, want to prove that I'm in this environment, I can hold my own in this environment.
And you've got to know everything. I remember so much pressure when I was at Guildhall and Academy to know everything about the pieces that we were playing in rep classes, for instance, when it's like, we're still learning. I don't know anything about anything.
There's
even
a lot
now
of shame
that I've graduated.
If you can't bluff your way through.
Yeah.
You know, and there are people, I probably am one of them, where I don't actually know very much, but I've like learnt how to know enough that I've like masked in every situation to like, because of this imposter syndrome, that I can like come across as being...
You ran an opera magazine.
Like knowing more than I... Well, exactly. And I don't know, really, still don't know very much about opera at all.
And we don't know much about podcasting.
Well, it's true. but I guess, can you give us an example of like a situation where your imposter syndrome has felt like most intense? Is it generally in terms of like comparing yourself to your peers or like looking ahead to other composers? I guess, how does imposter syndrome happen in composition and the composing world?
It can manifest in a lot of different ways. Firstly, I think this comes back to like in like the institutional settings like university or conservatoire or things like that. I mean, I'm very, very lucky that both at Birmingham and now at Guildhall with Opera Makers, that there's not really these elements of comparison or competition.
Between the students kind of thing.
Yeah, like it's not, like I'm very, very lucky and privileged that has not come across. A lot of it has been internal for me. A lot of it's been like, if I don't know X composer, or if I don't know how to articulate these thoughts or whatever, like, do I really belong here? And this also goes into outside of institutional settings, it can get even more like that. Because when, for example, like when I left Birmingham, I like, and I moved back down to London, I knew people, I knew a bit about the scene, but I wasn't, like, it felt like all the opportunities were very far out of reach. We'll go into this as well at some point, but...
Now.
Okay, brilliant. But it very much feels like there's, you know, after you're in like a, say, a conservatory environment, you're given a lot of, like, kind of opportunities and projects, or given the opportunity to put on your own projects. Like, for example, Birmingham were very good with us, and they brought in, like, Kator Bozzini and the Fidelio Trio, and they gave us the opportunity to, like, kind of curate our own performances at a festival at Coda. So there were opportunities to kind of have your music professionally workshopped and performed, as well as also organize kind of your own performances. And then to suddenly graduate, the environment becomes very different. It feels like the training wheels are off, but also I feel like a lot of the time we don't always leave with the skill set required to be able to kind of find these opportunities. And there's a lot I could go into here. I think there's something that, okay, I'm going to bring up Abel again. Abel Esbenshada has said something to me in some of the prep that I did for this podcast about how much of a solo career composition can feel like sometimes if you're not on the, you know, bit like large scale schemes, or you're not being supported by, like, say, like, you know, something like Safa or Cheltenham, rest in peace.
For now.
Oh God. Like, if you're not supported by, like, if you've not got those projects lined up, it can feel like you're kind of, you know, like, what's next?
Where do you exist?
How do you create the next thing? And I think in other worlds of classical music, because, I mean, I can't speak from a performance standpoint, because classical performance is not something that is really within my remit. But I imagine, like, when you're performing, because I'm, like, for example, if I'm playing in a band, like, I'm there in person, I'm surrounded by people, I'm surrounded by this environment. And with composition, especially when you're in that stage where you're between things, you're between opportunities, it can be very hard to find a support network. It can be very hard to find kind of like some grounding, essentially. And, like, I think everyone in, like, I don't want to speak for everyone in composition, but so many of the people that I know and in our kind of community of composers have felt that in some way of, like, just waiting for things to happen. Like, what happens if I'm doing this? Like, where is the next, like, piece of work going to come from? Like,
especially when it feels like a lot of people's career kind of takes off in their 40s and 50s. And if you're kind of waiting for that to happen.
Composers?
Well, sometimes.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know.
That's
what
I've
seen. They all seem to be in their 40s.
Because from my perspective as a performer, it's like in your 20s, 30s.
Really?
I feel like that's where a lot of my peers have gotten their, like,
big
first
break.
Job or, yeah, their big break. So it's interesting the different
ages. Well,
I don't
know, for sure. Yeah. But, like, I guess the big names I've heard of feel like they're older.
It depends. There's very much of course, like, when a lot of the spotlight can very much be put on, you know, like, more established composers, should we say, rather than necessarily older. But especially if, like, someone, quote unquote, blows up, like, and, like, suddenly see their name everywhere. It's what we don't see in the kind of public sphere is the years and sometimes decades of hard graft it takes to get there. Like, Lawrence Osborne is a composer I've recently featured on Preludes. The wonderful Patrick Ellis, who is the co-director of Preludes, interviewed him. And we put that out in the magazine. As of recording this, Lawrence Osborne Day at the Wigmore Hall has just passed. Essentially, the Wigmore Hall had curated this kind of portrait day centered on Lawrence Osborne and his work, in which Lawrence was in charge of the programming. A lot of his works were kind of performed throughout. And that was such an, it was so heartwarming to see. I saw all three of them. It was
there was
quite
a lot of publicity about it as well, actually. I saw it like everywhere, it felt like.
Exactly, yeah. But what we don't see is the fact that, you know, to reach that level takes a lot of time. Like, I'm thinking about, like, Lawrence did the Guildhall Opera Makers course quite a while ago. I don't want to say which year. I don't remember for a start.
That's exactly how we do it. We'll be like, oh, yeah. I couldn't possibly say it. It's like, we just don't know.
Couldn't possibly know either. But
he was also a Royal Philharmonic Society composer, as well as a composer on the LPO Young Composer Scheme. And these were also quite a while ago. And so you start to notice, you know, when someone's name, you know, quote unquote, like blows up.
Yeah.
It might look like a blowing up.
But it's a slow burn.
It's not, you know, everyone. And I'm happy to say everyone here.
Yeah.
Everyone in this field who gets to those levels, especially when they're older.
Yeah.
Have had to graft for it. Like, unless you're like a billionaire who can afford to splurge loads and loads of money on your own stuff, which, yeah, the 0.0001%.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of it is so dependent on, you know, the that kind of graft. There's also, you know, there's going to be elements of like luck in there as well,
and
elements
rejection.
Of privilege and rejection. Yeah,
yeah,
the privilege of rejection.
The privilege. We are, thank you so much for coming to audition.
Oh, don't. So, I mean, was setting up Preludes, which we probably should talk about as well, which was your kind of lockdown baby. We all have one.
We all have one.
I didn't.
Was that to do with this, I guess, lack of feeling and community? Or tell us about why you started it and what it is.
Yeah, of course. Like, for me, so the reason I started Preludes was basically, it was lockdown. Because I didn't really know much about kind of like how to notate when I first got to Birmingham. I had musical ideas, but really a lot of the course was finding my feet and then learning how to articulate that to especially classical performers. And it felt very much like the moment I felt comfortable with that, lockdown hit. And I was like, oh no.
Just want to give you a big hug.
and so there were kind of two major things I was feeling in April. Firstly, I felt this kind of like loss of experience and loss of education. Like, Birmingham had taught me so much, and there was for me a slight concern that I wasn't going to be able to, because I wasn't in the environment, like the physical environment, to learn about these things. That I was a bit worried that I would kind of, I don't want to say miss out, because Birmingham was so, so great. Like, during lockdown as well, they were so, so unbelievably supportive. I felt like there was a bit of, like, I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to, basically that I wasn't going to learn about the things I wanted to learn about because there was such a distance between everybody. Luckily, that wasn't the case. Luckily, they were, like, so wonderful with it. I actually moved to Germany during that time.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah, that happens. Lol. During, like, at least the second and third lockdowns.
For how long?
Like, 6 months.
What a legend.
I was dating someone out there, so...
Oh. Wowie. We get the hot tea on CMGTA.
Yeah, and then I moved back in March, and then that fizzled out. But, you know... Swings and roundabouts. Essentially, I felt very disconnected from both the experience of learning about composition and also the community of composers that had been so wonderfully cultivated in Birmingham, both between like the tutors and our cohort of students and between us as well. It felt like that was just ripped from us. And I just thought, like, yo, I'm going to need to, like, figure out how to learn more about, like, kind of composers who are operating right now, because, like, in education you will very much so learn about kind of like about composition but about lineages of composition, but there's a disconnect between, you know, the stuff that was made last month that was done at Wigmore Hall, for example, that stuff that, like, that was, I think, missing during lockdown a lot. Very, very luckily that the community did kind of come together in ways that made it less kind of, made that loss less palpable. But there was a loss, and it's important to state that there was a loss there. But also that loss of community. And I just thought, what's the best way of like trying to like kind of preserve what was created and what was there? And for me, it was just like, I'm just going to start interviewing people I know, predominantly friends at the start, and just kind of learn about their practice, learn about what makes them tick as composers, why they compose, their aesthetics. And that's kind of like how it started. And I kept that going throughout my second year at Birmingham as well. And then kept that going through after I finished at Birmingham, and after I started like kind of freelancing as well. And then our co-director Patrick joined in March of this year and has also been doing a few interviews with that. And for me, I've always wanted to keep one foot firmly on the like emerging composers ground, because it's so important that, like, especially now, especially with like all of the horrific funding cuts. And I mean, we'll go into this, but Saffa and Cheltenham and Dartington all going at the same time, it's kind of like, yeah, there's a real, it's, yeah, it's something, there's a feeling that's quite hard to describe, especially amongst us. Like, it was what, like, for example, Saffa did, bringing in like, you know, 18 to 24 composers every year and giving them a year-long project. Like,
there's nothing that can replace that, you know.
Yeah.
There isn't anything that, you know, that's there.
Feels like there's a lot of grief.
Yeah.
For like those kind of opportunities, and it just, yeah, feels very depressing.
It's, yeah, there's a real kind of malaise, I feel. It's very easy to get despondent about it. And I wish I had a quick fix, easy solution, like, hey, let's do a composing force scheme.
Yeah.
Oh, wait,
yeah.
There's no money.
What's the kind of general feeling about these cuts, or about kind of being an emerging artist right now among maybe people you've spoken to in your field, or just generally? What do you think? Is it a positive time, or does it feel like you guys are really struggling? What do you want people to know, I guess?
It comes back to, I think, what we were talking about before with regards to like opportunity or lack thereof. Like, I'm quite lucky in the sense that I'm now doing Opera Makers. I also, like, it would be very dishonest to say that like the current landscape didn't play a part in like now being a good time to do Opera Makers for me. Like, it would,
because it feels like a chance to retreat and learn and then go back out into it, or
it felt, yeah, for me, I think it was very much a, like, there were lots of decisions that played into it, but for me there was a strong kind of sense of like, I want to find a way to continue my, like, both my like composition, but also my learning, and how do I do that? And Opera Makers seemed like just such a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And it's been, yeah, it's been incredible so far. We'll talk more about, but yeah, I can't speak on behalf of everyone. But in the circles that I've been talking about it, or speak on people I've been speaking to, it just, yeah, it feels like there's a pool of opportunities that's just getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And there's also a similar sense of like because these opportunities are getting like the chances for these opportunities are getting slimmer, the chances for your name to kind of get out there get slimmer, like kind of alongside that. And like, while it's wonderful to be able to share in, you know, the victories of like seeing your friends being like, oh my god, this is fucking amazing, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, yeah, there's equally a kind of balancing act, I think, of like, I think just because of that lack of opportunity, one needs to take into account. I think the most important thing to state for me is that, like, in a time where this kind of stuff is happening, like, we have to be a community and not a competition. It very much feels like the, and this might be a hold off. I don't know if the word is hold off.
We'll see.
I think there can be a real sensibility of, like, or air sometimes that, like, oh, well, X person got Y opportunity. But it's, I try, and I think this is something that I've always been it's been a very important part of the Preludes, is that victory for one of us is a victory for all of us. Like, we are not in competition with each other. Like, if, you know, I want to be able to celebrate everyone's wins equally.
Yeah.
And
that would not be possible in a string world, can I just say? But I love that so much.
It's so important, I think. It's like, I'm going to talk a little bit right now just about the punk scene, like, that I was in Leeds and that I'm still kind of part of, because I still play in a band. And someone, like a kind of mentor who's been really, really close to my heart is Mark Bartlett, who is the label manager of Innit Records, which my band Trouble Sleeping are currently signed to. He put out our debut album earlier this month, actually. Oh my God.
What's it called?
The self-titled record of my band called Trouble Sleeping. It's like...
Oh, okay, nice.
Yeah, so Trouble Sleeping, self-titled. It's on nice. Innit Records, INIIT. But the reason that I bring him up is because he is one of the most supportive people that I've ever met in my life. It's the same with the entire ethos of him and the entire ethos of the punk scene that I've seen both in Leeds and then in London and now in Sheffield, which is where the band are based, is like, it's so supportive and it's so egalitarian. It's so, like, in a scene like that, you have to support it. You have to support the artists, you have to support the audience, you have to support everything, because without that, there's no scene. The scene is only as present. The scene is only as present as the people who make it. And that has been something I think has been a massive carryover for me going into the composition world. This might also be because I've not had a kind of quote unquote traditional classical education, but go on.
No, I was just thinking that there's... You talked about this kind of it all being supportive and not competitive, but everybody has to work so hard. Could you speak a little bit about, I don't know, it sounds like it would be very easy to burn out, even despite these supportive influences.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Especially with opera and knowing how all-consuming that has to be to produce an opera.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I mean, I'm not going to kind of like mince words and say I'm like experienced. I feel like I'm still very much at the start of my compositional journey. Even and especially in comparison to like a lot of the people I know and kind of share this compositional space with. And for me, I think there's a real sense and sensibility of, and this is something I think you've said once before, Hattie. Of,
oh dear.
I think you said that they've been binging our podcast and yes, we can't remember sorry. Any of our podcasts.
This idea of like, I think knowing when to say no. I'm very bad at saying no to people. It's very easy to operate, especially when it feels like opportunities are being stripped from us. It's very easy to have a scarcity mindset where you feel like you can't say no to people. There's been a lot of times where like I've just thought, oh, I need to take this opportunity right now. Like I can't think about it because what if there's no more opportunities? What if it all dries up? What if, and this is so silly, what if I burn out? Or not what if I burn out, what if I fall off?
Yeah.
You know? What if that's kind of it? What if I don't take this thing, then what happens?
I've heard so many similar things that you said about auditions and things. Like what if this was the one, or
it's like a gambling
kind of thing.
Like what yeah.
Well
like,
if I don't go to this gig, they'll might not ask me again.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
Or if I do this audition, what if they take me off the extras list?
It's it feels, once again, one of those things that, it feels like it kind of, it puts you in artificial competition that is not there. Once again, important to state that competition is constructed. Even if we are going for similar opportunities, it's so important to kind of like understand that, you know, there's, it might, like, even though it feels like a lot of the time there's not enough to kind of go around, I still feel like we need, like, in order for us to survive as a community, we need to band together and stick together. Yeah. But that's, sorry, that's getting off the point of burnout. And
that's okay. No, it's beautiful.
I really want to know about, like, is burnout a thing in composition that's very common, do you feel, amongst your peers?
Absolutely. I mean, like, I'm going to speak from my own experience because it's something that, while, like, a lot of people have spoken about, is not something that's necessarily talked about in depth amongst composers for a variety of reasons, one of which being that it's, like, it's such a solo thing. Like, when you're writing, like, even if you are the most collaborative writer, even if you very much, like, do devised work, like, I also have done some work for an immersive theatre company and still do, it still feels very solitary. And so I feel there's not enough dialogue and not enough communication between composers about that process. Like, writing just one piece of music, like, it takes, like, a lot out of you. Like, I'm one of those people that I used to just kind of, like, cycle things off straight away, just like bang, 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 bang. I think that's, like, when I started writing music, I just kind of didn't really give it any thought and just went for it constantly. And then after a while, I think it was after my, and the thing is I still do this, so I'm a massive hypocrite. But there's, like, it feels like you are giving it, okay, let's not mince words. You are giving a part of your soul away to an extent when you write. Like, it's so
you though, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, it takes so much out of you, and also, like, firstly, it takes so much out of you to just write, like, one piece of music, let alone, like, a massive opera. Like, I think Gavin Higgins said that, like, in your chats with him, that, like, it's just so all-encompassing. Like, and I think that a lot of composers, myself included, have felt similar ways about it. I think it's just not talked about enough, the impacts that has on your mental health, and especially when that goes out into the world, like, you know, and then you've got eyes on you, and thinking about kind of who's listening to it, in what environments is this being played, like,
is anyone going to criticize it?
Yeah, this is where, like, for example, like, spaces such as like a lot of concert series, like, I mean, Music We'd Like to Hear, or Listen Pony, or Tantrum, which is happening tomorrow at Eclectic. Sorry, this will not be coming out tomorrow.
Probably not.
Like, where they step in, because they're incredibly supportive environments for contemporary music and composers. But, like, there's a real, for me, I still feel an anxiety when I hear a piece being premiered of, like, God, are people going to like this? Does this work? Like, is this going to be, like, is this something that has value? And so much of your identity can also be wrapped up in this idea of, like, okay, is this value kind of, like, is there value in this? And because we give so much to our craft, that very much contributes to a lot of the burnout that I think, like, I face, and I think a lot of others face. I remember this was back in, I think, months and months ago. But, like, a group of us kind of got together for, like, a little one-off, like, kind of focus group, support group thing. Just to kind of talk about, like, oh, God, what's happening in our world? And, like, this was following the closure of SAFA. Like, what's happening in our world? How are we feeling about it? How can we kind of, like, adapt or survive doing the things that we do? And there's, at the moment, I think there's no easy answer. I think the answer is that we have to stick together. That's kind of, like, I think, sorry, I keep going back to this point, but it's because I think it's important with everything going on, like right now, like there can sometimes be this pressure to kind of like, yeah, there can sometimes just, there's so many pressures operating on us. There's also like, you know, as alongside all of this, there's like, you know, so many composers have to work extra jobs just to get by. There's like, you know, I know quite a few composers who have like 9-to-5s in completely different industries and are making a career in composition like work, or have to make it work to continue creating work. Or like composers who kind of do other things as well, like composers who perform, composers who teach, like. And that's also something that I think isn't really talked about enough as well, that there's can sometimes feel or be this pressure to be like, oh, well, you know, like, oh, well, I don't do this thing, or I, you know, like, I'm not going to talk about the fact that I work at a pub 2 nights a week, you know, type thing.
As you'll know from listening to all of our podcasts, we always end with a win of the week.
Oh, gosh, this better be quick.
It will be fine. So is there something small or big that you feel has been a part of your week, or maybe the past couple of weeks, that you've been like, yeah, I am amazing?
Yeah. You go first, Siggy.
Oh.
Oh, you're talking to me?
I think it's polite that we go first, okay, to give our guests time to think.
Okay.
I'll go first. I had really intense therapy on Thursday and Friday, and my therapist kind of prompted me to take some time for myself afterwards, which then led to me cancelling some teaching.
That was massive.
Which was, and I texted Hattie like, I've just cancelled some teaching for the first time for my mental health. And yeah,
it's a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Wow. Mine is kind of similar, actually. Well, like all of last week, I just struggled to like struggled to get my brain in gear, I guess. I couldn't get in the zone like I normally can with work. And I guess two sides to that. One was I just kind of have a renewed understanding of maybe what it's like to deal with ADHD or like an attention problem, because I just couldn't do anything. I felt really paralyzed in terms of work because of maybe feeling burnt out. And I just felt like a renewed kind of empathy with people that deal with, you know, neurodivergence or like brain not being in gear. So yeah, Ziggy.
I completely resonate with brain not being in gear all the time.
It's so frustrating.
And so we're at the point in the interview now where we were asked to leave the Royal Opera House for being a health and safety hazard. So I'll leave you with Ziggy's voice note, win of the week. Thank you so much to Ziggy for their time and for putting up with a chaotic recording session. And thank you to you, the listener, for always being here and being with us on this journey of talking to people and figuring out what the hell is going on in the music industry. Now over to Ziggy.
Okay, so my win for today is from this past weekend. I've been exchanging messages with an opera composer I really admire about kind of like the ethics of discussing and portraying difficult subjects in opera in ways that don't kind of trauma dump or implicate the audience. And even though it stemmed from kind of like a lack of understanding on my part, I feel very, very grateful that I'm able to have this conversation. It's made me realize how much I'm grateful for this person as well for giving me the time. And it's really feeling like an important step in learning about how I navigate certain subjects in opera and how they will become more integrated into my practice. That's my win! Yeah!